Welcome to Designed for More, brought to you by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Join Dr. Timothy Jennings, a renowned expert in psychiatry, neuroscience, and spiritual well-being, as he explores the connections between mind, body, spirit, and relationships.
Hello, and welcome to Designed for More, sponsored by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. I'm Dr. Tim Jennings, joined today by Danielle Rome, one of our therapists, and Chaplain James Johnson, our chief of chaplains here. And today we, again, are privileged to have a special guest, Katie McPherson, and because we're doing another special topic today, the topic is families as systems, how teens are not the problem. And Katie, tell us just a little about yourself and your experience.
My name is Katie McPherson, and I have been in the schools for about 30 years. I'm also the mom of four beautiful teenage daughters, currently ages 16, 16, 17, and 18. So I'm living in a small estrogen tide pool.
Okay. And we're so glad you have been part of our program today. And our conversation is about family systems. And what do we mean when we say family systems?
So I get a lot of phone calls. I do a couple different things. I teach internet safety and social media responsibility, but I'm also a youth mental health advocate in my own community. And I get a lot of calls as sort of the first responder in the neighborhood on teens about like, what is wrong with him? What is wrong with my teen? He's doing this. What is wrong with her? Why is she reacting this way? And I always, you know, from my many trainings over the years, I always like to point people to, you know, we all have a dynamic in our family to play and everyone has a different role. And so when we're talking about something that's escalating or something that's worrying you, I believe that we as parents need to take a step back and do some self-reflection around, you know, what's my part in this dynamic and what is driving this behavior and really getting to root causes of like how the whole family is interacting.
So we say family systems, you're saying that the teen who is the identified problem is a member of a larger system and their behaviors may be a manifestation of a family crisis or family dynamic or family stress that teen's behavior is bringing to light rather than just blaming the teen for the dysfunction as a reflex.
Yeah, I get a lot of calls like, where can I send him to fix it?
Okay. That almost may be diagnostic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it sounds what we call externalization. We have no role in this. Fix him and send him back. It's like the car is broken down. Send it to the shop. Bring it back when it's running again. I mean, that almost sounds like there's. And if you hear that, what does that tell you about maybe how that family works?
It's just, you know, it screams to me they need strategies, strategy, 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 because, you know, I know when I interact with my daughters and I'm frustrated and they're frustrated and we don't take that time and space to, you know, both have calm brains to have a reasonable conversation, it doesn't go well. And so, you know, when these people call me and their child may be escalating or experimenting with substances, you know, my first question, if they're vaping or if they're smoking pot all the time, is what's his why? Why is he smoking pot all the time? What is this? Is this typical experimentation or is he numbing out stress? Is he trying to escape from something? And by and large, there's typically, you know, I ask a couple more questions like, well, grandma died during COVID and he's very sad about that. And then we moved and then his dog passed away. Like there's always something that it's about. And parents, not always, but tend to point to he or she is the issue and not some of these internal and external factors that are happening within the family system itself.
So within the family, is there some benefit to the family to take the approach that you've just described? In other words, the family benefiting by not looking at the family, but by blaming the teen? And if so, what is that benefit?
Benefit in blaming the teen?
Yeah. I mean, they do it. If it's happening, this is what we call in psychiatry, like a secondary gain or primary and secondary gains. In other words, there's an underlying reason that the family is doing it. It has some reward for the family. If the family didn't do it, it would have a consequence that the family is trying to avoid. I'm throwing it out there. So if this is happening, I don't know if you've thought that through. I can unpack that. Danielle maybe can unpack that. You want to unpack that for us?
Yes. I mean, so we refer to that role of the person that takes the blame for all of the issues as the scapegoat. So basically, the function of that is if this child is being blamed for all of the issues, then the parents don't have to look inward at the rest of the issues potentially happening in the system or mistakes that they've made. It alleviates temporarily and unrealistically, but it alleviates the need to take responsibility for.
So if there are, we're going to make the assumption that they're all human and they all have roles to play and they've all had shortcomings and mistakes that they've made. But if it's that person's fault, then it avoids any guilt.
Yes.
Any shame, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And nobody likes those emotions. This is a way to have one feel better about themselves without actually having to address their own shortcomings by finding someone in the family who is the problem for the family.
Yes, absolutely.
And so is this an uncommon dynamic?
It's very common, and especially, you know, me working at Honey Lake, seeing usually the people that come in, not all the time, but often are the role of the scapegoat. So they come in, they've been told they are the problem. And then as we get to talk a little bit more and unpack more of their story, it starts to be revealed that maybe the family
Let's keep unpacking this, though. The person in that scapegoat role, the one who's being blamed, the teen or the late adolescent adult, is, if you look at their history, is their history free of bad choices and like free of doing drugs, free of having self-harm issues, and they've been really well adapted and they're just being blamed? Or do you find that they actually have a history that seems to conform to the scapegoat role?
A lot of the time there is a history that conforms, but sometimes what's missed is that those actions are then escalated in response to being put in a rigid role in the family system.
Well, this is what I want to point out, though. I want people to understand this, because the very superficial thinker, well, that's not us because our kid actually, you know, got caught drinking underage. And our kid really did get arrested for a marijuana violation. And so that's not us. We're not scapegoating. I mean, it really happened. He really did it. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we're not scapegoating anymore.
Yep.
Okay. So how do you say to those families that say, no, that he really was caught shoplifting. Okay. So he did it or she did it. So we're not scapegoating. They did bad stuff. So it's them. What do you say to that?
Well, I mean, of course, it depends on the family and other factors, but something that I've seen is it started with maybe a smaller action, and then they got put in that scapegoat role when they were younger, and maybe the poor behaviors were not as extreme.
I want to reverse you even further.
Okay.
Because you started, it said it started with a smaller action. Mm-hmm. If families are scapegoating, is it even ultimately starting with the action, or is it starting with who's responsible or how so-and-so is feeling?
That one, yeah.
I mean, isn't that really where it starts?
Absolutely. Yeah, with what you're saying, yes, I would agree with that.
Okay. What the small child having whatever their crying episode.
Yeah.
And they're now they're upsetting the parent. They're interfering with the parent's ability to enjoy the ball game. And so they're being blamed for ruining the day.
Yes. Yep. And then in that situation, the parent may even vocalize to the child, you are ruining my day. You are ruining this experience with your big emotions. And then that can escalate. So going back to the original question about what if there is actual evidence, right? My child robbed the store, right? Okay, but it probably started.
This is my point, yes.
Exactly.
Okay, the system, and this is, I think, the point that Katie wants us to understand, is that there's a system in place on how things function, who's responsible for what, and it may start with stuff that is not as obvious, but it ultimately leads to obvious problems. What are your thoughts, Katie?
Well, I tell people often, you know, this thing happened, all behavior is communication, so that we often prescribe to the behavior, especially in schools, like he threw a chair. Put him in the special desk in the front office. Like, that's the behavior. But what is the emotion that, you know, escalated so that he threw the chair? We often don't take time to get to the root cause of the behavior. And we have a phrase in schools And I think it's an African proverb about, you know, a child that's not welcomed by the village will burn it down. And we have children, specifically in my experience, you know, in my front office experience as a school administrator, you know, 95% of the kids sent to my office were boys doing typical boy things. But when they don't feel like they're seen, heard, and loved, they will find a way to get you seen, heard, and loved, both boys and girls. And so, you know, what we see in front of us looks like negative behavior, but often is this cry for help, or often is this cry for attachment. And if there's no attunement there, they're going to fill the narrative of the scapegoat. So by the time you get to 11, 12, 13, 14, and substances are available, or pornography is available, or video games are available, I get a lot of calls about what is wrong with him. And often there's a runway there.
What do you see as the biggest commonalities in, maybe we'll just have to call it, family systems that aren't working? I was going to say dysfunctional, but family systems that aren't working well. Are there certain underlying themes that you see consistently showing up?
I have two, and then I want to pass it over to you guys. One is mature adults doing the work and repairing those child wounds they have themselves. We have some adults that are emotionally stunted, who are reacting in ways that are emotionally stunted to children. And then secondly, adults that are using substances themselves to manage all of those things that I just said, that are modeling for children, like, this is the way that you can escape. So especially in the teen years, when kids have access to substances so readily, you know, it's, what is wrong with him? Why is he vaping and smoking pot? Well, if he's watching mom and dad have, you know, a vodka martini every night, or, you know, moms joke around all the time, mommy needs her wine. And then we wonder why our teenagers think that that might be an escape as well. So those are the two themes, you know, adults being mature adults and doing their own hard inner work. And then the modeling of how do we deal with stress, I think, are the two things that pop up for me.
So I've said in a talk I did many years ago, Fix for Failing Families, healthy relationships require healthy people. You can't have a healthy relationship with a significantly dysfunctional and unhealthy human being, no matter how healthy you are. It's just not possible. And healthy families require healthy parents. If the parents are dysfunctional, you cannot have a healthy home with dysfunctional parents. Now, I use the word healthy. I didn't use the word flawless or perfect. And some people hear that as flawless. No, healthy people are people who can own their mistakes, look in the mirror, learn from them, update, improve, and let go less adaptive ways of doing things and incorporate more adaptive ways of doing things, forgive, repent. These are all mature and healthy. It's not that, and ultimately are loyal people. Okay, you can't have a healthy relationship with somebody who is untrustworthy and unloyal. So within the family, a healthy parent, a healthy homes require these attributes in the parents in order for the home to be healthy. And I heard you say, when you say maturity issues, basically you're saying the same thing. They're not healthy. And so the first thing, if a parent is having a lot of difficulty in their home, they might consider themselves getting in with a really good, competent therapist to deal with their own stuff and become the healthiest version of themselves. And I do this with my patients who are going through divorce. And many of them are going through divorce because they're emotionally not as mature as they could be. And thus the relationship was not very functional and it's collapsing. And then now they're individually collapsing. And I point out a truth to them. And because we don't know what's ultimately going to happen in the future in this relationship, but there's two possibilities before us. One, they reconcile. One, they divorce. And I say to them, true or false, either path, don't you need to be the healthiest person you can be in governance of you? Either path. Don't you do best either way? And so rather than focusing on how the relationship turns out, focus on becoming a healthy person. Same thing with the children, okay? Your child gets in their own treatment and they get really healthy or they don't. Isn't it true? Either place, you need to be the healthiest person you can be in governance of you. And so having that
as a starting point within a home, that each person is willing to look in the mirror, get the coaching, if that's what it is, coaching, counseling, whatever it is they need to deal with their own selves and learn the skills to deal with that other person. But what are your thoughts about this, guys?
I agree completely. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the ripple effects, I mean, I think probably just saying the same thing a different way, is an unhealthy, immature person will end up setting unrealistic expectations of other people they're in relationships with. So, you know, maybe they, you know, grew up and maybe they just had a dynamic, you know, relationship with one of their parents, and they put that on their spouse and they say, oh, you should be acting like my parents did, in whatever shape, form, or fashion, or a movie or a television show that they saw as the epitome of perfection within that family system. And then when whoever's in that system doesn't meet it, the spouse or the children, then they end up putting that condemnation and putting that unfair expectation when they can't meet it, well, then, oh, they're the problem. You know,
so talk about expectation. I think that's important, because expectation could be from two different motivational energies. We expect someone to do something for us, to fill a role that we think is the right way for them to live. I mean, there's that kind of an expectation. And I think that's what you meant.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. But there's also the idea of the expectation of a loving parent for the health and welfare of their child.
Right.
Okay, which is a very altruistic expectation. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's what you meant.
No, no. I mean, you know, like, if you have, you know, this expectation that, oh, you know, I grew up in a home where dad was the worker and mom was the stay-at-home mom. And so every day when my dad came home, there was food on the table, the house was clean, all the kids were disciplined and happy, and all the homework was done. And then that's not the type of, you know, the spouse that he married.
Non-reality-based expectation.
Yeah, yeah, unrealistic and non-reality.
Okay.
Yeah.
So an expectation that a baby will dirty a diaper
is realistic, yeah.
A baby's going to cry through the night to get fed.
Mm-hmm.
I expect that to happen,
mm-hmm.
Okay? That is not a problem.
Right.
Yeah. So realistic expectations is okay. It's when we have these either unrealistic first, or expectations that they do something for us.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me.
Yes.
That is the, and then when it doesn't happen, it results in anger, hurt, disappointment, judgmentalism, attempts to direct, control, enforce. I don't know. I'm throwing this out there.
Yes, absolutely. And something that I'm hearing too is when a system is rigid. So the idea that certain people just have to fill certain roles in the family for it to work. And by roles, I mean like the person has to be the scapegoat to take responsibility for everyone else's issues. This person has to be the peacemaker. They have to be the person that keeps the peace. This person has to be, you know, the rescuer, the one that comes in and fixes everything. And what happens when these roles are so rigid is that when one person gets healthy and actually starts behaving in a way that is more flexible, valuing their own boundaries, developing more of an independent sense of self, the rest of the family system can start to collapse because it relies so much on each person filling
each
role.
Before they start to collapse, what will they do? In the scenario you just described, what will they do?
Reject or be angry or...
But what, to the person who's trying to get healthy,
yes.
What will they? Will the person who's actually getting healthy and stepping out of the assigned role,
yeah.
If the other family members are not getting healthy, will they experience the support of those family members, or will they experience constant sabotage and attempt to push them back in or pull them back into the dysfunction?
Yeah, sabotage, criticism, rejection.
I want people to recognize
conflict.
That.
Yeah, increased conflict, increased. Chaos.
You know,
yeah.
I use the example of scorpions. You know how to keep scorpions from escaping? Ooh. All you have to do is put them in a bowl together. As one tries to climb out, the others pull it back in. They will not let crabs do the same thing.
Yep.
Crabs do the same thing. They will not let the one try to escape. They will pull them back in.
Yep.
And these families function very much like this. Somebody's trying to get out of the dysfunction, they get pulled back in unless they're willing to emotionally sever the ties. And this is where the law of liberty that we talk about comes in, that setting other people free to be mad at you if they need to be mad, to criticize you if they need to have their own perspective. You give them freedom to think what they want to think. You do not give yourself freedom to be unhealthy. You give them freedom to think you're unhealthy, which is quite a bit different.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. What about, and I've never been a big believer in this, when I say believer, as in causal. I'm open for influences, but not cause, because I'm really a more of an autonomous person who likes an individual's autonomy to overcome whatever factors. But a lot of people take within family systems seem to value what is known as birth order. Mm-hmm. Have you heard anything about birth order in family systems? And what are your thoughts about that? What have you seen? What difference does it make?
I've seen recently, actually, like a lot of, I don't even know the word, like trendy things on birth order, as opposed to research-based and evidence-based research around it. It's certainly something that I've thought about, but I view families for the individual people in the family. I have a set of twins that came together that are fraternal, drastically different. I parent them very differently based on who they are. They react differently to me based on who they are. And so for me, like the birth order thing is not something that I personally subscribe to.
Any of y'all heard any concerns about that? Questions about birth order? I've never been a big, I remember some of my colleagues were, you know, like big into that for a while. But to me, it was always about the individual.
We try to do that. When I was a kid growing up, that was definitely the family system I grew up in. My brother was the oldest, and so he was always in charge. If my parents left, you're the oldest, it means you're the wisest. You must be in charge of everything. You know, my sister was the youngest, and so she was always, because she was quite a bit younger than my brother and I, she was always kind of, oh, you're the baby. You know, she didn't know any better. She's the baby. And
So what you're describing is a family who assigns a family, but that's not what the typical birth order is about.
Oh, okay.
But no, what you're not wrong. You've described how parents can use birth order to assign responsibility and assign roles within the family. The typical birth order is about, because you're the firstborn, you actually have different attributes and character traits that you develop being firstborn than secondborn versus the baby. And these are not assigned overtly, like you've described, but they are internalized because you occupy a different position in the order. And therefore, as a different position in the order, you are treated differently innately. Like oftentimes, I think most people would see this most cleanly with either the firstborn or the baby. The baby of the family is always the baby of the family and gets babied by everybody in the family, from all the older kids who treat them, you're the youngest, you're the baby. And they actually get told and treated that way in different ways throughout their life. And so that could influence their developing self. And they might not be given as much freedom, the last one to be let go from the apron string and so forth. And so this is the traditional way. It's not overtly assigned. It's more covertly experienced, that you have different experiences. Other classes. Examples of the birth order would be the first child is the child the parents have most anxiety about, most fear of messing up. And so they are the most hypervigilant over, watching over the pacifier, you know, the classic example, the pacifier falls on the ground. The parents not only pick it up, they go and boil it for 3 minutes and sterilize it before they put it back in. The second child, it's up and it's washed off in the sink and put back in. The third child, it's off the floor and in the mouth. Okay. And this type, and that's a great example of how parenting experience changes parenting style, and thus each child with the same parent doesn't necessarily experience the same things as parents learn themselves how to parent, or and whether positive or negative. So this idea then that they have different experiences because the parents parent differently have an impact on their developing sense of, you know, anxiety, the firstborn with all the germs and all the fear, and the third one is like, well, what's the fear? So yeah. You're smiling, Katie.
Yeah. My older girls are like, Mom, you did such a good job with like the first two of us. But like by the time it got to the twins, I think you just kind of gave up. So what you're describing is like, because they see the leniency, right? I mean, you get tired. There's so many of them. You're one person. You're like fork and spun. So yeah, I agree.
Okay. So family systems, teens are not the problem. We're talking about the idea that teens or children will often act out. They act out, the big ones that will cause acting out, if there's some abuse going on. If there's abuse going on, kids will often act out outside the home in various ways. Their grades can fall. They may turn to substances. They may become violent at school. They may become disruptive. Their behaviors can change if there's abuse going on. And so that can be a signal. And then that is a signal that there's a system or family problem. And the abuse may not be directed to the kid. And maybe the kids see mom get beat by dad every night in the house.
Yep.
And then marital conflicts. Any thoughts on marriage conflicts and children, teens' health?
How those are resolved or not resolved, and how parents deal with conflicts. You know, is there a lot of yelling? Is there screaming? Is there name calling? Is there shaming? Or is it, we're going to take this to a private area and discuss it and restore each other and, you know, be mature adults? I think just being a child of divorce myself, my parents' war, so to speak, was a silent war. Like, we knew something was going on. We knew they weren't getting along, but it was like a radio silent tension. And, you know.
Did that affect the children in the home?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. My sister, the firstborn, became sort of the caregiver of the, you know, the rest of our sister. We have four girls in my nuclear family, too. So she became almost hyper vigilant about us as they were doing their thing. She sort of overcompensated for that for many, many years and became a therapist. So, yeah. And just absorbing that energy of knowing like something's going on, they're not getting along, this doesn't feel right. You know, I didn't live in an abusive vocal home, but the silence was almost, I would assume, not as bad, but it was definitely a tension that we absorbed as kids.
And kids do pick that up. And this is important. The parents set the atmosphere of the home. The atmosphere. And what you described was a certain atmosphere. And I don't mean oxygen, nitrogen the atmosphere. I mean, the emotional atmosphere of the home is set. Is it a place of tolerance, of grace, of love, of healthy discourse and disagreement and even argument under the umbrella of we're all family and family can disagree, but we, at the end of the day, we still have each other's back and we support each other and we work out those differences. That can be very healthy. Or do we have a home in which you can only disagree to a certain point and then you've got to hold it in? You can't have a conversation. You go to your separate corners. You pout, you sulk, you sabotage behind the scenes. You hate until it's forgotten, but then it's really a residual resentment after that. These types of things. And what are your thoughts about this?
Well, you know, and it makes a lot of sense when you say that. I mean, because kids are watching, you know, they're always kind of figuring out what does right look like. Well, if this is how mom and dad handle conflict, that must be how I should handle conflict with other people. And that makes sense that it overflows into places like school or their other relationships. The question I have, and I don't know, maybe you guys hopefully you can help me with this. What do you do when those external stressors happen to a healthy family that upset the balance? Like, for example, I was having a discussion with my girls and almost a year ago, remarking how, you know, I went to the Middle East with the Army for a year back in 2019. You know, it's almost 6 years ago. And I said, wow, that was doesn't feel like it was that long ago. And they said, yeah, we were. And they said that was how did they say it? They said that year was scary. And even though my wife did a great job, you know, but it was that time being gone to them created an atmosphere from an external stressor. I like to hope that our family is healthy. But during that season, maybe I was thinking about things like medical diagnoses, financial stress out of nowhere, you know, some situation that upsets the norm in the family. Can you know, do we just accept that as that's just there? Or is there something we can do about it? Because obviously, if it's an unhealthy family, you can get healthy, you can mature, you can go to therapy, you can understand yourself. But what do we do when those life things come out of nowhere to upset the family balance that will impact children as the, you know, like you said, the culture setters that the parents have? Like, what do we do to address the external things that are unexpected?
Well, I think using it as an opportunity to teach how do you integrate these experiences? How do you grow from them, right? Instead of, you know, we're not going to talk about it, we're going to push it under the rug, or we're just going to cope in unhealthy ways. Discussing it in a way that becomes educational, and also the parents being able to model how do we cope with things that happen like this in life, because it is scary, it is difficult. But using those as opportunities to actually teach the kids. Mm-hmm.
So there are events, you get deployed, interpretations of events, how they get internalized, how they get experienced.
Yes.
And those experiences are both instructive, cognitive, okay, and emotional experiences internalized. And the children will primarily internalize based on the atmosphere set by the parents, regardless of the words you say. And you've all felt this. Have you ever been in a classic example that the kids have had an argument and the parents tell the kids, tell your brother that you love him. I love you. Okay. The words are love. Nobody believes there's love in that heart at the moment. And so the kids are much more resonant with the undercurrent of the emotional state of the parents. And if you were deployed, regardless of the love and maturity of your wife, I can't imagine she wouldn't have anxieties and concerns. I would. But how does she manage that in a way that mitigates to the degree that the kids don't live frightened?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the challenge. And to the degree that she actually is able to manage that and has peace, and we trust the Lord with the outcome of these things, and creates that you know, hedge of the Lord's protection around the family, that can mitigate a lot of it, okay? But at the end of the day, there will be, if they had I suspect they have a very positive bond with you, that missing piece, no matter, even if they're not even fearful, you know, we knew where you were going to come back. We trusted the Lord with that. Maybe they say that they had no doubt about that. There's a year they didn't have you.
Mm-hmm.
And your presence, and this goes to normal childhood development. So your presence creates safety for them, period. If you weren't in a war zone, you were simply at a other type of in the country, no danger, away for your job, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
They may very well, because your presence, if you're a healthy, loving parent that provides structure and good boundaries, that actually makes them secure, makes them feel safe. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense, yeah.
Okay. And so there may not be anything to do about that except to have those conversations and have what Katie described earlier, that place where they can come to your wife. And then to the degree you're able to do, you know, FaceTime or whatever type of conversations where they can actually talk about those things. Mm-hmm. And that confidant where they can just talk through their fears is the healthy point. But yeah, life happens. We have patients who parent died. Grandma died. The house was in Los Angeles. How many homes, how many families are displaced? Okay, lots of stress. But the kids and parents need to know this. What's most important to kids is not stuff. It's the relationship with the parents. And if the parents are healthy, they will go through those difficult external stuff and come out of it really well. But if the parents are not healthy, then it doesn't matter how much good stuff they go through, they're going to have problems. What do you think about that?
So this is probably an extreme example, but this past year we had a group of boys who were going around town beating other boys up using brass knuckles. And these children are affluent and have all the things. And, you know, there was a lot of talk about rich kids getting everything, but not having the presence of the parents. And when you lay out the families of the children that were involved, they have all the things and then some, but the presence of the fathers was not present. And within the homes, there was neglect, abuse, and domestic violence. And so you can have all the things and then have these behaviors be sort of that reaction.
And those teens end up being exactly what we're talking about, symptoms of a system problem.
Yeah.
They're acting out because the home is very unhealthy.
And so, you know, the conversation, unfortunately, they ended up murdering someone by beating them up with their bare hands and the brass knuckles, a boy. And so the whole town flipped upside down and, you know, people were like, send him to prison, all these things. They didn't get very much time and now they're going back to those same family systems. And so, you know, all the work that might have been done in rehab or juvie or all the things, they're going back to that same atmosphere you're describing.
So studies have shown that that the best home for children are a two-parent home, father and mother in the home, in which there is reasonable maturity and no violence, no unhealthy conflicts. Conflicts are okay if they're healthy and resolved, you know, discussions and disagreements, but no violence and no abuse. That's the healthiest home. The next healthy home for kids, though, is a single parent home in which there is a mature parent and no violence and no unhealthy types of conflict. That kids do better out of that home than a two-parent home where there's ongoing abuse and conflict. Maybe not abuse to the children, but where one parent beats the other parent, there's ongoing raging and hostility and conflict. Kids don't do as well as they would in a peaceful, mature single-parent home. And the worst home of all is a single-parent home where there's abuse and conflict. That's the absolute worst. And this is a wake-up call, because a lot of people have been told that the two-parent home is better than the single-parent home. And if all the other variables are equal, that's true. But if there's abuse going on in a two-parent home and a healthy, mature structure in a single-parent home, then the single-parent home is actually better than the two-parent abusive home. Does that make sense to everyone?
Yeah. And I hear a lot like broken homes, like broken single-parent homes. And that word broken bothers me, because a lot of people have left and had to divorce due to what you just described.
Yeah. And one of the things that we run into, I'm glad you said it that way, that a lot of times we have the question come up being a Christian clinic is, oh, I thought God hates divorce. And we get to clarify, yes, God does hate divorce. But more than that, he hates the destruction of his created children that he loves, you know, that we would much rather see, you know. And one of the other things that I think we fall into the trap of a lot of times of thinking that a relationship is broken beyond repair, when a healthy parent may step up and say, we can't raise our children like that. We can't be in a home together until we're both healthy. And that doesn't mean they can't get healthy and come back together. It's not all this or all that. But I'm glad you said that, because one of the things that I've seen so many people do is they hold on to toxic marriages for the sake of the children.
And they're harming the children while they're doing it. So sometimes families will hear that, and some of the couples will separate, get healing for the benefit of the children. There are others, though, that even when they hear that what this dysfunction is harmful to the children, they're convinced of it, they still won't separate. Saying they stayed together for the children was actually their excuse to actually stay in an enmeshed codependent relationship. They don't know who they are, don't know how to function with that other person, so they actually still even won't separate. And what they'll probably do is find a new therapist who will tell them that it's okay to stay together. Okay, rather than doing what's actually objectively healthy and healing. So I think that's what's going on.
Yes.
With some, yeah. So, Katie, you had one more thought you wanted to share?
Yeah, just really for moms, like, and dads too, but really moms are shouldering a lot of the daily routine. And, you know, as you age into your 40s and 50s, there are hormonal changes going on for you, and teens are going through this rapid growth and development of puberty as well. And sometimes those things sort of clash. And so some of the reactions we see from teens are hormonal reactions, and mom is also going through this journey as well. So I'm living it myself and watching some of my friends really sort of try to find, like, where is my place as mom as my teenager takes flight and has more freedom, has girlfriends, boyfriends, job, not home as much. You spend a lot of time building for this moment, and then you're like, wait, they don't need me anymore. What do I do? And so there's just a lot going on there. I think that is an ingredient in this talk about family systems.
Well, and that's an important one. And I would say to all the parents, particularly the mothers, but the parents, is that that they should anticipate and prepare for a role, a transition in identity. Who am I? Why am I here? I'm a spouse, unless I'm a single parent. Maybe I'm not in the role of spouse anymore. But I'm parenting for years. Maybe I have 4 or 5 kids. Maybe it's a 25-year parenting run. But then eventually the kids launch. Who are you? What's your purpose? There needs to be something more than just the children. That is... so honorable to be that parent and be dedicated. But if you do your job well as a parent, the goal of doing your job as a parent is parenting in such a way you can quit parenting. I mean, that is the goal, isn't it? That they launch and they become autonomous and independent. And then you've parented yourself out of the parental role, so to speak. And then there needs to be something else meaningful for your life. And so I encourage some parents along the way to be thinking about that. What's that next step going to look like? What am I going to do with my life when the kids don't actually need me to parent anymore? And then, of course, there may be a brief period of time. I will encourage most, but not all, may be able to step in the role of grandparent. And then you'll have that joy again with the small ones around, and that can be fun. But that identity piece is important. And think about who you are, and your identity is more than the role that you fill. That's important for people. Thank you for joining us today. I hope this was meaningful and helpful to you. If you have questions, send those into questions@designformore.net. Questions@designformore.net. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you for joining us on Designed for More, brought to you by Come and Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Also, don't forget to check out our other podcasts for more inspiring content.
All right, thanks, Wayne.